You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
All right, it is Wednesday, June 1st, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. I just made it. From the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Folks, forgive me. I just had to use the Majority Report helicopter paid for by tax dollars to make it to the show on time today. A great show for you. Guy Lawson from Rolling Stone Magazine will be here to tell us of the wonderful story you may remember back in the day, the Stoner Arms Dealers. And then later in the program, we'll be talking to independent journalist Ryan Gallagher. I believe he's in London, who spent some time in Spain with Los Ignorados. Meanwhile, hold on for a second. Everybody just duck your heads. Helicopter's going to take off. Thank you. See you in an hour and a half. They come by, they'll pick me back up. Governor Chris Christie arrives at his son's baseball game yesterday aboard a state police helicopter. During the fifth inning, Christie and the first lady, Mary Pat Christie, got into the car, rode back to the helicopter, and left the game. They couldn't even stay for the full six innings, ladies and gentlemen. Chris Christie takes a $12 million helicopter, which can reach nearly 200 miles an hour with its twin turbo shaft engines. They are designed for homeland security duties and transporting critically injured patients. In this instance, Chris Christie had to get to his son's baseball game. Shared sacrifice, ladies and gentlemen. We all know that there are no parents out there. There are no parents who can't afford to get a babysitter or can't afford to take a couple hours off of work to go see their kid in a play at school, or can't afford to drive to a baseball game because they got to work overtime. That doesn't exist in this country. Shared sacrifice. Everyone has the same opportunity to get into their $12 million taxpayer-paid helicopter to go see their kid's baseball game because of all their official duties that they have to fulfill that would make it impossible for them to drive there. Now, of course, Chris Christie, in this instance, had no public events in his schedule that day and had to get back to Drumthwacket, the governor's mansion in Princeton, because he was meeting with a group of Iowa donors who are expressing his desire to run for president in 2012. Shared sacrifice by everyone, says Chris Christie. Teachers, screw you. State workers, screw you and your pension and your health care. A tunnel under the Hudson to increase property values and create jobs for New Jerseyites, screw you. A fantastical mall that is a tremendous eyesore? Here's $200 million worth of tax breaks. My son's got a baseball game? Fire up the helicopter, guys. Come on. What did we spend that $12 million for?
I'll argue that it was an emergency. It was critical that he got a hot dog at that baseball game.
There you go. It's the only place I can get a cheap hot dog. Look, I appreciate a parent who's going to go to see a game, but the idea that this man could talk about shared sacrifice when he is causing people in New Jersey to work overtime and get no pay, when he's talking about cutting back on pensions for people who have been promised it for 20 years, when he's talking about a pay cut for state workers because he decides that we're not going to meet our obligations to these people, when he talks about cutting teachers and causing other people's children to suffer because they're in bigger classrooms. Unbelievable. This man has swallowed his integrity whole, and you can just see it when he stands to the side. We got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Guy Lawson from Rolling Stone magazine. Guy will be flying in. Here he is. We're bringing him in on his helicopter right now. Fuck, we're not going to use a phone. I'm going to fly up there, interview him, and fly back. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is my pleasure to welcome to the program man who cooks a great shank of beef. He is the contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine, Guy Lawson, here to talk about his awesome piece in Rolling Stone magazine. March 31st, Rolling Stone magazine, The Stoner Arm Dealers, How Two American Kids Became Big-Time Weapons Traders. Welcome to the program, Guy.
Hey, Sam. How are you?
I'm doing great. This story, I remember when it broke in the Times back in the day. It sort of disappeared. And this is one of the funnest sort of most disturbing stories I've read in a long time. It's about these two guys, David Packhouse and Ephraim Varoli. Tell us the story of these two guys and what it has to do with the new normal in America, as far as I can tell.
These are two kids who live down in South Beach. They're both Orthodox Jewish kids that went to the same yeshiva, and they were just really smart kids who had had developed an extensive taste for marijuana and money, I suppose you'd say.
Now, when we say kids, we're not talking like we're a couple of old fuddies, and these guys are 30. These guys were in their teens.
Yeah, one of the kids is Ephraim Divaroli. His father and his uncle were involved in what you could call the arms trade. His father just sold sort of Kevlar vests and things, but his uncle was a real gun dealer to police, to law enforcement, and Divaroli apprenticed to him after he got kicked out of high school. And so he spent about a year or two working for his uncle, and the kid is just a genius. The kid had a native touch for it. You might think of it like computer hackers, just like somebody who has a passion for it and an instinct and an ability. So he set up on his own. Like, he rented a room from this Latino family in South Beach when he's 16 or 17. I guess by then he was 18. He started up his own company called AEY, and he began to bid on federal arms contracts. Federal law requires that all contracts be placed online at a website called FedBizOps. If any of your listeners want to start dealing arms, it's just that simple. You can go on and start, you know, bidding on contracts. I mean, there's obviously things that you need to do to qualify, and the world of arms, you know, bidding for Pentagon contracts is pretty arcane, and there's lots of forms. This Divaroli kid was just excellent at it, and so he began to bid on small, kind of obscure, hard-to-do contracts that the big companies wouldn't be interested in, like, you know, supplying a couple of hundred AKs from the Soviet Union to train special forces in Germany. Things that, you know, that the huge, you know, all-consuming Fortune 500 companies wouldn't bother to bid on, or wouldn't really, you know how to bid on it as nimbly as he could, because he had no overhead, no staff, no anything. And so he started to win these little contracts.
He was sort of like the Majority Report of arms dealers, in a way.
Yeah, yeah, and aiming to be, you know, Rush Limbaugh.
There you go. And so he builds essentially a track record and a credibility for himself by doing these small-scale jobs.
Yeah, you call it past performance. And pretty soon, within a year, the kid's a millionaire.
Wow.
And he says to his buddy, Packhouse, who's like the smartest kid in their group, and this is, you know, this is a group of smart kids. These, you know, there's a way in which the Times portrayed this. The New York Times story, if anybody remembers it, is like that David Packhouse was a masseuse and that Divaroli was a lunatic. There's lots of ways in which this story doesn't match up with the facts. So this story is much more complicated. They're really bright kids. And so he says to Packhouse, you want to come in with me? And Packhouse says, dude, how much money have you made out of it? And Divaroli, you know, fesses up and says, I've got $2 million in the bank. And, you know, Packhouse is an aspiring musician, but he's like doing massages out of Craigslist. He's not sure what to do with himself. He's going to college part-time. So he joins up with Divaroli, and they start to, as a for-commission kind of collaborator, and they start to bid on these various contracts. And Divaroli continues to succeed. Packhouse is struggling as an apprentice. But then, you know, in 2006-07, the Bush administration, and this will, I'm no doubt, give your listeners such pleasure to recall these days. The Bush administration realized that its Afghanistan policy was going to hell in a handcart. And the concern that was later conveyed to these kids is that the Pentagon and the powers that be were worried that a Democrat, if elected, might withdraw from Afghanistan, should we be so lucky, right?
That's the most hilarious aspect of the story, almost.
Yeah, so they decided to basically dump as much ammunition as they could possibly buy into Afghanistan in order to make sure that their, you know, comrades in arms weren't abandoned in the field. You know, needless to say, the blowback from that will last a generation or two.
Right.
So they put out this thing, this solicitation, it's called, for 100 million rounds of AK, 25,000 million drillion RPGs, just literally scour up the entire Eastern Europe, put it on an airplane, and dump it into Afghanistan.
Ugh.
And so this contract is a one, winner take all. One bidder, one contract, and so, you know, without a number attached to it, so all these massive companies go out and bid. So you have, you know, 20 companies chasing this, and one of them is AEY. And so this is just David and Ephraim literally in the living room with a volcano, you know, the pot vaporizer?
I've heard of it.
Yeah, sort of a stack of high quality weed, you know, working around the clock, calling up, sorry, just some kids playing, calling up every arms dealing nefarious Eastern European company and getting quotes, getting prices. So, you know, they basically throw in a bid. Divaroli, it's his money, so he's sort of in charge. He doesn't know what to bid. He's like, do I bid 10% margin, 5% margin, 12%? He's trying to guess what the, what price will get him there. He bid $299 million and like $99.99 kind of thing. And we don't know to this day how much he actually beat the next bidder by, but it was on the order of $100
million. Wow. So he underbid his competitors by $100 million in bidding, basically $300 million to deliver all of the loose ammunitions that are floating around Eastern Europe.
as much as they can get there. Basically, America's foreign policy in Afghanistan, which you could argue, as then-candidate Obama was the single most important foreign policy objective, was in the hand of two stoners, one a high school dropout and one a masseuse.
Oh, my God.
And so they proceeded to try to fulfill this contract. And what the story portrays, and the larger project that I'm working on, which will be a follow-up book, is that you know, the kids become the portal into the world of arms trading, arms dealing, and the nexus of politics and violence, and really, you know, the Technicolor version of the Bush administration, like literally everything that was awful about it, all under one roof, you know, so, including the naivety, the adolescent attitude, the double dealing, the mealy mouthing, and the amorality. I mean, it's an incredible story, and the magazine article really only touches, you know, gives you, I guess, you know, sort of an introduction to, a cliff note to, and as Sam and I, as we discussed the other day, there's lots of stuff that is yet to emerge that I'm reporting on that'll, I think, point in some very interesting directions. But the essence of it is that the kids imagine themselves to be kind of, you know, latter-day Victor Boots or, you know, Khashoggis.
Right. Now, these guys, they ended up like, I mean, the story, people have to read this because it cannot be done justice. The idea of these guys on the phone freaking out with some guy in.
I'll jump to that real quick. But basically what they do is they fall in with this Swiss guy named Enrique Tomei, who's, you know, who is the real world. He's the actual arms dealer in all this. You know, he's their conduit to the big time deals. And one of them is in Albania. And Albania, if anybody's been there, as I have, you know that it's basically one big arms cache. You know, it was the most paranoid government on earth for decades. So these kids were emptying out Albania under the watchful eye of the State Department and Pentagon. And it all goes really, really wrong when they discover that they're selling Chinese-manufactured ammunition.
Now, why is that a problem?
Because after Tiananmen Square, the American government, in its infinite wisdom, put an embargo on all Chinese-manufactured ammunition. Now, the fact of the matter is that this ammunition was given to Albania in the 1950s and 60s. So you can do the math. That predates Tiananmen Square by decades. So while it is, quote-unquote, Chinese ammo, in what sense is it really Chinese ammo? You know, when does it become Albanian ammo? The kids... There's lots of ways the kids could have played it, literally 100 ways to play it, and they chose the worst, which was to try to lie and to hide it, to take the ammunition out of its Chinese marked boxes, sardine cans, put it into cardboard boxes, and ship it all to Afghanistan. So that's what happened. It resulted in a local Albanian businessman getting in a dispute with the corrupt Albanian officials, which led to his demise, quote-unquote accidental demise. And that sort of, that also proceeded to, led to a tip to the New York Times, who then spent a year and 8 different reporters on 4 different continents reporting the story, which resulted in a front-page story, which in turn resulted in the indictment of these 3 kids and one older gentleman who had been part of their financial who'd been a financier for them. And, you know, what you basically have is the story as portrayed is of 2 really, I guess you'd call them idiotic, corrupt, greedy kids and 2 other people who were associated with them trying to victimize the American government and sell crappy ammunition to the innocent Afghanistani army and police.
So it's basically, dude, where's my armaments?
That's the story that the United States Attorney's Office wants you to believe. That's the story that the New York Times covered. It's actually completely and totally wrong. And I hope, as we've discussed, Sam, I can't really talk about it yet, but not to be cute, but it suffice to say that the American government was not fooled by this. They were getting what they wanted. And when it became public that what they wanted was crappy Albanian ammunition, and they didn't care if it was from China or Paraguay or anywhere. They just wanted the ammo. And when it became apparent that this was the Bush administration's policy, and this will probably be familiar to your listeners, someone had to carry the blame, and it wasn't going to be the Bush administration.
So there's obviously a lot more to this story. This is basically chapter one. I mean, in some ways, it's basically the introduction to this story. It's the story that is...
I mean, I should say there's a lot of cocaine use, sex, swearing, and fun along the way. I mean, if I'm making it sound dry, it's really not. I mean, the story... Which, if you want to read it, you can read it on my website.
Which, again, is also very much why we call this the, it's like the Majority Report of arms dealer stories.
Right. Similar to your set. I don't know if I want to plug it any particular way. It doesn't do me any good. But if anybody wants to read it, it's at my website. It's at GUYLAWSON.com.
Yeah, we will post a link to this. So now, just give me a little bit of background. Like, how did you do your reporting on this? I mean, how did you traveled to Albania? Where else did you travel? Who did you talk to?
What happened was, I read the New York Times story as you did, and maybe a lot of your listeners did. It just was such an outrageous story, and there was something about it that just didn't ring true. You know, it seemed a little pat that these two teenagers would somehow fool the whole world.
Right.
You know, I mean, you're talking about...
Because these guys actually sat down and they met with Defense Department. It wasn't just like it started
constantly
in their living room, but they actually had face-to-face contact.
Constant contact. They were chartering hundreds of cargo planes. Tens and fifties and hundreds of millions of dollars was hitting their account. This ammunition was in wide use. It remains in wide use in Afghanistan. It's just, you know, the idea that everybody, you know, it's like the Humphrey Bogart movie where,
I'm shocked to hear that there's gambling going on.
I'm shocked to hear that there's dishonesty and conniving involved in the arms dealing business. Poor American government. So I was talking to my editor at Rolling Stone, and I've been repeatedly covering the Mexican drug wars, and that was getting a little old. So I said, what do you guys want me to do next? Like, what kind of story? And they said, I don't know, young kids doing fucked up things. So I went through the Rolodex of my head, and I thought, this is the best young kids doing. Can you swear on this, on the Majority Report?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. Sorry. What I basically did, it's a bit of a... secret of the trade is that, you know, I used to be a lawyer. I know how the legal process works. And the moment you can approach people to talk to you is when they're right after they've been sentenced, right upon the time they're being sentenced, because all the jeopardy detaches from them. So basically, I went down and to Miami Beach and talked to a defense attorney and to one of the kids. And now I'm going to be in touch with the other of the kids. And so, you know, it was really a matter of having a good sense of timing, a good luck in timing, and then also having the venue, as Rolling Stone does, you know, and I think a lot of your listeners will recognize this, to be critical, and to be to tell stories that, you know, if I was down there for the New York Times, I would not be able to tell the story the way
right.
It needs to get told.
Well, listen,
and that's a real criticism, I think, of the press in this age.
Absolutely,
and how complicit it is.
All right, well, Gee, it's an amazing story, and we're looking forward to the book and the update. But thank you so much for joining us. The website is GeeLawson.com. We'll have a link at majority.fm to...
Can I just put in one little plug?
Please.
Yeah, you know, I'm starting, for your listeners out there, I'm starting a draft Mark Green for mayor.
Well done. Yes. Well, we'll certainly have you on to talk about that. Maybe we could have a debate.
Go get him, Sam.
All right, Gee, thank you so much for joining us.
Talk to you later. Bye.
We got to take a break. all right, let's do. Let's hit a story here before we go to Ryan Gallagher in overseas talking about the Los Indignados. It is amazing story. That Gee Lawson story, folks, you have to read it to believe it. And he is going to continue reporting this in a book that he's working on, there's a lot more to this story, which is sort of shocking as you walk away. But there's, you know, dude, where's my car doesn't happen in a vacuum. And so stay tuned for more of that. Guy's a great writer and has some amazing other stories that he's working on. And hopefully we'll have the opportunity to talk to him again in the future. A story out of the well, this one's coming from Too Much. Sam Pizzigatti. He is looking at a new report from Ad Age. Now, understand, Ad Age is a magazine that is not political in any way. They are looking at this. They are basically doing a report for Madison Avenue. Who's buying what and who do we sell to? A new white paper from Ad Age, Mass Influence, the journal has declared, is over. In other words, the age of a middle class, which you sell to, is done. Why? They don't have money anymore. The Mad Men 1960s America, where average families dominated the consumer market, has totally disappeared. This Ad Age new wave of affluence study details. Madison Avenue has moved on. Taking inflation into account, Ad Age goes on to explain the incomes of most American workers have remained more or less static since the 1970s. This is not a political report. This is a report that basically says to those people who want to make you believe that you smell bad and everything you do is wrong, so you should buy crap, is put out for those people who are going to inject that notion into your brains. While the income of the rich and the very rich has grown exponentially, the top 10% of American households, the trade journal adds, now account for nearly half of all consumer spending. And a disproportionate share of that spending comes from the top 10's upper reaches. Simply put, sums up Ad Age's David Hirschman, a small plutocracy of wealthy elites drives a larger and larger share of total consumer spending and has outsized purchasing influence, particularly in categories such as technology, financial services, travel, automotive, apparel, and personal care. America as a whole hasn't quite caught up with this reality of steep inequality. Americans still, quote, like to believe in an egalitarian ideal of affluence where everyone has an equal shot at amassing a great fortune through dint of hard work and ingenuity. It points out that the odds of someone's worth amounting to $1 million have shrunk to 1 in 22. As the very rich become even richer, they amass greater purchasing power, creating an increasingly concentrated market for luxury goods and services as well as consumer goods overall. You wonder why the establishment in this country doesn't care about the middle class. Ad Age has given you the answer. We don't need to sell to these people anymore. It's enough that they will buy food. It's enough that they will buy cigarettes. It's enough that they'll buy gas. And then everything else we sell, we're going to sell to the richest anyways because they're the only ones with the money. Before the Great Recession, Madison Avenue conventional wisdom put the great stock in the 100,000 to 200,000 income demographic. A consuming universe populated largely by men and women 35 years and older. These aspirational households could afford a taste of the good life. They rated as worthwhile advertising target. Targeting this 100,000 to 200,000 cohort, the Ad Age report contends, no longer makes particularly good marketing sense. You understand what this says. They don't need you to be consumers anymore. So why in the world would they care if you've got a job? Why in the world would they care about your stagnant wages? The underclass, and by that I mean 80% of us, no longer have the leverage to get the plutocrats to give a shit about us. That is the biggest problem we are facing in this country today. And because those plutocrats also control our government because they have more money to influence the electoral process and the legislative process, we have no leverage with these people anymore. And what is left? I don't know. Maybe it's what's happening in Europe. And we're going to go to Ryan Gallagher, who has been reporting on Los Indignados, to give us an update on what is happening over there. We'll be right back after this. All right, folks, we don't have Ryan Gallagher. You know, it's not easy. Overseas, different time zones. We will hope to talk to him later in the week. But continuing on with this theme, we have a situation in this country now where even the ad agencies are now saying, that's all she wrote, folks. There's no point in selling to the vast amount of Americans in this country because they can't buy anything. It's a waste of your advertising dollars. The Detroit Free Press reports on another element of this. Not only have we destroyed the middle class in this country with 30 years of stagnant wages, with the lack of redistributive power of our tax system, where you have the wealthy elite in this country, the multimillionaires, paying a fraction of what they paid in taxes 50 years ago. The Basic Economic Security Tables for Michigan, a study that analyzes the cost of essential needs for singles and families across Michigan. And there's no reason to believe this is any different anywhere else. Michigan's not exactly a particularly expensive place to live, with all due respect. Found the cost of providing basic necessities such as shelter, food, and transportation far exceeds the minimum wage and paychecks of people working full-time in low-paying job categories. So we have Madison Avenue telling us, hey, we're no longer going to waste our money. We're no longer going to waste our money trying to sell to the middle class. And then we have this report, single Michigan residents without children must earn $12 an hour to support themselves. A mother with two young children needs $24 an hour to house, clothe, and feed children. That's three times the minimum wage. The report was done by Wider Opportunities for Women and Michigan League for Human Services. It's staggering, says the league's president. And here's the amazing stat. You have unemployment rising, dropping, but the number of requests for food assistance is climbing because of many of the new jobs being created are low paying. So if you put $60 worth of gas in your car, you can't buy your kid milk. With these kinds of salaries, you can't support your kids. You can't buy them clothes, save for college, have any money on hand for car repair. And a lot of these jobs have no health insurance. With these incomes, it's nearly impossible to cover the expenses, even if you work 80 or 90 hours a week. Just stunning what has taken place in this country, and the complete lack of urgency that we're seeing by our leaders to fix it, to address it. We never hear the word jobs anymore. We never hear the word wages anymore. It's ridiculous. All right, we're going to try one more time to reach Ryan Gallagher. You can all hang on and listen for this here. If this works.
Welcome to Orange Answer Phone. I'm sorry, but the person you
called. All right, it's not working. All right, so we'll do one more story, and then we will head to the post show. Yesterday, the so-called clean debt bill, and I apologize for not being more specific yesterday and more in-depth on this. Bill was brought up by the Republicans to prove that there is no will by the Republicans in the House to pass to raise the debt ceiling without cuts like in destroying Medicare. Simultaneously, as they were getting ready to vote on this bill, the leadership of the Republican Party was calling Wall Street, telling them, this is just theater. It's all pretend. Don't worry. We're going to raise the debt bill, the debt ceiling, but ignore us. And in fact, we'll do it after the markets to minimize anybody's panicking. Don't panic. It's all fake. And what they were attempting to do was to split the Democrats, because many Democrats want to just raise the debt ceiling and move on. But what they added into this bill was Section 1, a finding. The Congress finds that the President's budget proposal, budget of the United States government fiscal year 2012, necessitates an increase in the statutory debt limit of $2.5 trillion, more or less. Now, this, of course, was a lie. The reason why they're raising the debt ceiling is because of the budget in 2011, which has already been passed. They have spent this money. Now we just need to borrow it to pay for it. So many Democrats voted against this bill so that they would not lock in this false notion that Obama's budget has raised the debt by $2 million. So it is... all of this is coming at a time where we now have real estate prices that have dropped more dramatically than they have since the Great Depression. We're back down now to where we were in 2009. You remember 2009, that was essentially right after the entire financial markets imploded. The idea that we're talking about cuts and austerity at this point is ridiculous. But we are, and we will see if the Democrats cave and give up the only political advantage they have going into the 2012 elections. And, you know, they're going to need it if the economy is heading in the direction that most economists that I respect feel that it is. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back with the post show. You can call me at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. We'll take your calls. We'll take your IMs at Majority FM. Folks, if you can become a member, it is greatly appreciated. Like I say, we're not going to go away this month, whether we hit our projections or not. But over time, the hole is going to get deeper, and it's going to be harder to maintain the show. If you can become a member, please do. Not only do you get access to the post show, which we talk a lot of stories, we get feedback from the audience, you can hear things like today I'm going to be talking about my calling into Tom Sharpling's show yesterday to yell at Marc Maron and make him cry. That's for members only. Why did I do it? How do you make Marc Maron cry? All these things only members can know. Where was I last night when I placed that call? Was I at a Hollywood screening? Well, not technically, it was in New York. But it was very Hollywood-ish. That and more in the post-show. Or you could just become a member to support the show. All right, folks. See you tomorrow. Whoa, 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 whoa. If you've listened this far in the show, first couple opening bars of La Poupée, then you're obviously a very intense listener of the Majority Report for free. And I'm going to give you this little bonus from the members show today just to wet your whistle. Just to increase your appetite for the post show. Stuff like this happens all the time. Usually I'm nude. Today I wasn't, but this was still good material. So please, if you're thinking about becoming a member, please do. We need your support. You don't know what you're missing on the flip side. Why not get an extra little bit of material every day? So here is this clip. This is what you would have heard if you were a member, and you're hearing only today by the grace of God. Well, actually, Evan just cut this together. Okay, bye. Last night, it's true. Marc Maron was on the best show on FMU. Now, a little trivia. Many of you may or may not know this, but the Majority Report was born on WFMU during the best show in February of 2003. Tom Sharpling invited me on to do a version of the Majority Report. John Benjamin came to the studios with me, did the intro live. I had on the show as a guest Jeanine Garofalo. Jane Garofalo. And then some dude, I can't even remember. I don't know if he's still in. But it was from Fox, and like the weekend Fox guy. And I just shat all over him. I mean, really. And I was talking about saying that this war is a huge mistake. We should leave the weapons inspectors in there. I was reading from the Project for a New American Century. I think it even may be down there. I'm not even sure. Is there a folder there that says Majority Report, like with colors? Mm-hmm. Is there? Yeah. Pick that up. This thing here, bring it over here to me. This is what I brought to prepare for that show, for one show. I mean, I was nervous. I had never done radio before. Here it is. This is the book from that February 2003. And wow, I did. Look at this. Look at all this research. Here is, I remember this article. Those principled Europeans by Thomas L. Friedman. Last week, this reads like a frickin' parody. Last week, I went to lunch at the Hotel Schweizhof in Davos, Switzerland, and discovered why America and Europe are at odds. At the bottom of the lunch menu was a list of the countries that the lamb, beef, and chicken came from. I remember this. I've quoted this many, many times. I don't think I've read it since then. But next to the meat imported from the U.S. was a tiny asterisk, which warned that it might contain genetically modified organisms, GMOs. My initial patriotic instinct was to order the U.S. beef and ask for a tartare, just for spite. But then and I and my lunch desk just looked at each other and had a good laugh. How quaint, we said. Europeans, out of some romantic rebellion against America and high technology, were shunning U.S.-grown food containing GMOs. But even though there was no scientific evidence that these are harmful. Well, of course there's no scientific evidence. How many years have we been using genetically modified food to feed our cattle? You know what was also funny in 2003? There's no scientific evidence about cell phones. They're perfectly safe. You fucking moron. But practically everywhere we went in Davos, Europeans were smoking cigarettes with their meals, even though there is indisputable scientific evidence that smoking can't kill you. Can't kill you. You know when else there wasn't evidence that smoking can kill you? 50 years ago, you fucking idiot. But that's not what this piece is about. The piece is all about the next line. So pardon me if I don't take seriously all the Euro whining about the Bush policies toward Iraq. For one simple reason, it strikes me as deeply unserious. This fucking article should be dunked in amber and placed in a massive monument in the center of the country. They should tear down the Washington Monument and place this article in a vat of amber. And then they should take Thomas Friedman and put him in some, like, platinum-constructed stockade, like a stockade constructed out of platinum. And they should force the angle of his head up so that he just is constantly staring at this one article he wrote. I don't take seriously all the Euro whining about Iraq because there's an asterisk and they're telling people you may or may not be concerned, you may or may not care, but we're going to give you transparency that the meat you're eating has been fed genetically modified feed. He goes on to say, they are the diplomatic equivalent of smoking cancerous cigarettes while rejecting harmless GMOs. Alas, where this comes from is weakness. It can make you stupid. I guess so. It can make you reject U.S. policy simply to differentiate yourself from the world's only superpower. Power corrupts, but so does weakness, said Joseph Joffe, editor of Germany's Die Zeit newspaper. Europe's cynicism and insecurity masquerading as moral superiority is insufferable. Each year at Davos Economic Forum, protesters are allowed to march through the north end of town, where last year they broke shop windows. So this year on demonstration day, all the shopkeepers at that end of town closed, but when I walked by their shops in the morning, I noticed that three of them had up signs in the window that said, USA, no war in Iraq. I wondered to myself, self, why did the shopkeepers at the lingerie store suddenly decide to express their anti-war sentiments? Well, the demonstrators came and left without getting near these shops, and guess what? As soon as they were gone, the anti-war signs disappeared. They had put up simply as window insurance to placate the demonstrators so they wouldn't throw stones at them. Unfucking believable. This scumbag. Unbelievable. Anyways. That was a long way of saying that. So Marin's on the best show in FMU. Are you kidding me? That's worth $10 a day.